that. Okay, I'm hoping that we're actually recording the second half of this presentation. I think we are, but so so far we've essentially discussed different network characteristics, the idea of packet switching as suited to computer networks versus circuit switching is suited to voice networks. And I forgot we had one last topic within the network basics category, and that is the layered architecture. Okay, and again, we sort of have this idea that networks are quite complex entities. We were talking about hundreds of millions of nodes, multiple paths, multiple types of traffic, lots of different uses. So in an attempt to sort of divide and conquer, a basic sort of model for a network architecture has arisen. And this model involves layering. Okay. And the idea here is that for each component in the model, we have very specific functions and very well-defined interactions with other components. Okay. And this is nothing new to networks. Anytime you have a complex design problem, the first thing you try and do is break it up into smaller, more manageable pieces. And then, of course, you have to describe how the pieces all interact together. So the idea of having a network architecture, it's exactly the same thing. What's sort of specific to networks is the idea of layering. Okay, so the components have even more restricted interactions with each other than might be found in other types of systems. Specifically, you have a stack of components, one sits on top of the other, and the components only talk to their neighbors. So any component will talk to, or any layer talks to at most two other layers. Okay. And so what we'll look at here is first what the concept of this layering. We'll try and get it again, if you've worked with networks, it's quite obvious. If you haven't worked with networks, if you haven't thought about it before, it's a little bit strange looking. So we'll have a quick look at just what does this layering mean. And then we'll look at a reference model specifically for networks, the OSI model. And then we'll look at the layering in practice, which would be more the TCP/IP protocol suite. Okay. So we'll start with an example that has nothing to do with networks. We have an airline customer service here. The goal is to get customers to pay money for tickets and then have a service of being transported somewhere across the world. Okay, so what we see is that there's a number of jobs that need to get done, and there's a specific order in which those jobs need to be done. Okay. So at one end, the customer has to buy a ticket. After that, they go to the baggage check-in. They check in their baggage. They go to the gate. They get onto the plane. They take off on a runway. The air traffic control tells the airplane specifically where to go. The airplane starts flying. There's some aspect of relay in the sense that if they get close to another major airport, they will be given more route. The airplane will be given more routing information. They get to their destination. They're told when it's safe to land. They land. The passengers get off at the gate. They claim their baggage, and then they go to the ticket office to complain about how awful the service was. Flying Ryanair, or Aer Lingus, for that matter, or British Air, or any of them. Okay, so what we see here is, again, this idea that there's some very specific tasks, and then there's an order in which they need to be done. One, then the next, then the next, then the next, and when you get to the other side, you sort of rewind that process. So, again, if we want to think about sort of interfaces, well, in order to check in your baggage, you need to show your ticket. In order to go onto the plane, you have to have gotten rid of your baggage somehow. And the plane won't take off until everybody's loaded, etc. Okay. So, we have this idea of sort of step 1, 2, 3, 4. That forms layers. Okay. Now, as you go through, one layer is dependent on the next. Okay. So again, the baggage layer is dependent on the ticket having been provided. When you're going back up, you in general don't go to complain until you've found they've lost your luggage. So there's a relation between them and an interaction between these layers. There's also sort of a distributed interaction between the same layer in the two different points. Okay. So unless you purchase the ticket, you can't complain. Okay. Unless you actually checked in baggage, you won't have anything to claim, etc. So there are two forms of communication, really. There's actual communication going on down through each of these layers, and then there's more of a virtual or implied communication going on sort of across layers in different places. Okay. So this layering is the same concept as what we'll get in a network layered architecture as well. Okay. So what we're going to do is divide up the problem into a number of tasks that need to be done, and we're going to see that they quite naturally sort of again have this sort of linear progression. You need to do one first, then the next, then the next, then the next. That leads to the layers. We'll also see that as you move through the network, what's been done at a given layer, is important to what's done at the same layer at a different point in the network. Okay. So, again, if we think very simply, we start with one point wanting to connect to another point, and indeed, the action wants to go somewhere much farther away. Okay, so you want a connection that goes a fair distance. Okay, so the first thing you need to do, really, is have some way of sending a message point to point. Okay, and you need to do that. Yeah, there's some requirements about how to send that message point to point. Okay. And sometimes we want that message to be correct. We need it to have certain characteristics. Naturally, that's not sufficient. Again, if you're thinking about getting halfway around the globe, you'll need to go through a number of points to do so. So we need to have something that just physically transmits our message around the globe through a number of these nodes. Okay. And then finally, well, I'm sending a message to some other user. Well, they have to have some way of understanding the message I want to send. So if you're thinking about sending email, well, at some level they have to be using the same or similar protocols to process the email. Okay. So, it's also, we can see, again, this, the layering in the sense that, well, first we need to get it physically across. Second, if it's getting physically across, well, we need to make sure it has certain characteristics. Third, once we have that connection, well, we need to have some way of making multiple connections of the same type to get us to the end. And fourth, once the message arrives at the end destination, we need to interpret it. Okay. So, we have the layering, and we have some idea of how many layers we need within a network. Now, there's a lot of debate about exactly how many layers are needed within a network. We'll have a look at two different models that use two different numbers of layers, and arguably neither of them have it quite right either. Okay. So, as we saw with our airline example, the actual communication is going down through these layers until you hit your bottom layer, at which point, well, actual physical communication has to happen. But there's some sense that the functions that are being performed by the layers are meant for remote layers. So, you should be able to, the most straightforward example of that is, again, if I'm running an application here and I want to talk to an application here, again, these intermediate nodes really don't care what the application is, but the remote layer is going to need to process the actual data I sent and make some sense of it. If I'm sending email, the guy at the other end needs to be able to make some sense of the email I sent. Oh, great. Okay, I can just get rid of this, I think. Okay, sorry about that. I think it's finished processing the first half of the notes. Okay, so there's one other somewhat technical issue that's specific to communication networks, and that's how the data gets packaged up. And again, within communication networks, a design principle was put in place that lower layers don't care about the actual data given to them by higher layers. Okay. So the meaning of the data given by a higher layer only matters to, again, the remote component of that layer on the other side. If I'm a lower layer, all I'm going to do is view that data as a bunch of bits that I have to do something with. I'm going to do what I need to do. It doesn't matter whether I get one bunch of bits or another bunch of bits. I'll do exactly the same thing. And usually I add some piece of my own data onto this collection of bits that I've gotten. And that extra data is meant, again, for my corresponding number at a remote location. Okay. So the first model I'm going to mention is the OSI reference model. And this was developed in the late 70s. And it was developed when the telephone networks started thinking about transporting computer data. And this is one of the problems with it, is that essentially they weren't too clear on what the sort of the applications were. They tried to sort of get a very impose a very connection-oriented paradigm on the connections, and they got all this stuff up here that nobody really uses. Okay. But it's very popular as a way of talking about network architectures, because at the lower levels, they actually got things reasonably correct. Now, having said that, nothing is specifically implemented for these networks, but it's used, or therefore this model. So it's not really an architecture in that sense, but it's used as a discussion point. If you're talking about protocols, you usually say this is a network layer protocol, this is a data link layer protocol. Okay, and again, it was the first to sort of codify this idea of the layered architecture and exactly what was meant by it. Okay. So in this case, they defined 7 layers. And again, data starts with a sender and it moves down through each of these layers. It's passed down until it gets to the physical layer, at which point it's physically transmitted. Okay. Now, what do each of these layers do? Well, 5, 6, and 7 say something about end user applications. We won't worry too much about what they say, because again, nobody actually likes what they say about it. But some way of describing end user applications and what end user applications should be. Okay. So for our purposes, we just say that this generates a bunch of data. Then we get to the transport layer, which they actually got pretty right. The transport layer reflects end-to-end connectivity. So if you have a data stream, what sort of connection do you have to this stream? Do you hold a session open while a stream of data is coming, or do you send the data packet by packet? The transport layer determines that. Since it's end-to-end, the only nodes that worry about it are the sender's node and the receiver's node. Below that, you get into stuff that happens at all the intermediate nodes as well. Okay, so as you're transmitting your packets from one node to the next node to the next node, how do you do that? So the network layer is concerned primarily with routing. So how do you determine the path through the network? And again, if we're looking at packet switching, well, that's done at every node, and every node considers what the next route should be. So at each node, the protocols of the network layer have to be active. Okay. Then you go down to the data link layer. That's concerned with point-to-point connections. And it's concerned with the issue of taking bits and making sense of bits as a collection, as a group. Okay? So it, you want to be able to recognize the stream of bits as a packet, as distinct pieces of information. The data link layer is concerned with doing that. Frequently, it's also concerned with things like, how do I get these packets incorrectly, not just incorrectly, but correctly as well. Okay, and finally, the physical layer is concerned with the formation of bits and then the pushing them out along a link so that they're received at the other end. Okay, so what happens? Again, I have an application. I've got some data I want to send. That data is passed down through all these layers. Each layer adds a bit more information to it. The layers don't really, they don't care what the bits are for the other layers. They don't examine them. They just add their information to it. Okay, and then again, it travels down until it hits the physical layer. And at that point, it's the bits are physically transmitted to another node, to another place. Okay. And again, depending on what's happening at that node, whether it's your final destination or just an intermediate point, you have to go back up through some of these layers. So if you're talking about an intermediate node, you receive the bits in, they have to be passed up back up to the data link layer that again forms them into packets. The packet has to be examined by the network layer for an address, and a decision has to be made as to what the next node should be, and then, again, it drops down and back down to the router and is sent along. Okay. So, again, this next slide is specifically talking about this idea of encapsulation. So we have our data at each point. Additional data is added on to that, and the data that's added on is significant to the corresponding layer at the other end. So as we go down, the last person to add on data is the data link layer. The bits get transmitted. When they get passed back up, the data link layer on the receiving end examines the information that was tacked on that's significant to it. It tells, usually says something about how to decide whether the data was sent correctly or not. How was it packaged up into packets? Things like that. So it makes all those decisions. You have a packet then, and that can be passed on to up through the layers. Okay, so again, this is just a quick summary of what the different layers do, but I think you have an idea. Again, if you want or need to know more, then the best thing to do is just pick up a textbook. Okay, so just popping back for a minute. The OSI model is used specifically that it's used as a reference model. People often talk about the different layers, well, particularly the first four layers, transport, network, data link, and physical. And whenever they're designing, they pretty much design within these layers. Again, some of the layers have been broken up. In some cases, the implementation is not quite so clean. But it's used to discuss networks because it's a pretty it is a good representation of, at least at a very high level, what happens. Okay. Now, for various reasons, it never made it past the model stage. Protocols were pretty much never implemented that did exactly what was said within the reference model. Okay. Now, there were a bunch of reasons for this. Part of it, again, was too much telephony. Nobody really liked the top three layers. Again, as things emerged, some of the layers sort of were overly complex. If you, again, examine the data link layer, usually it, in turn, gets split in two. And if you examine implementations, the issues of the data link and physical layers are often blurred and merged in ways that aren't apparent in this sort of a model. Okay. And also, at the time people were talking about this, a whole suite of protocols was being implemented, specifically the TCP/IP protocol suite. Okay. And the TCP/IP protocol suite had a view of the world which was close to the OSI model, but not exact. Again, they had a much more realistic view of applications, and started populating sort of the application layer with a number of, again, the very simple applications that form the foundation of a lot of what goes on today, file transfer, mail transfer, hypertext transfer, etc. Okay. The transport layer, well, it was again much more oriented towards what was required of computer applications, and the core protocols within that, if you've heard of them, would be TCP and UDP. So one essentially allows you to have a connection-oriented approach to data transfer. So it allows you to set up an end-to-end connection, and UDP, again, has a more a packet-oriented approach to data transfer. So again, you send data packet by packet. Okay. The network routing, well, did pretty much what the network routing was supposed to do. Again, it's important because of the protocol that was implemented, IP. IP has become the protocol of computer networks. It's sort of the one thing you can count on in a computer network is that it's running IP. Okay. And then at the link and physical layers, well, they let people do what they want on this at this level. Okay. They didn't really seek to regulate it. So the protocols at the point-to-point level, and again, dropping down into the physical layer are sort of whatever works for you. Okay. So altogether, that leaves TCP/IP with roughly four layers. Again, it would not be sort of so well-defined a model. When people talk about models, they try and graft it onto the OSI model. It's more of an implementation. Okay. But again, you have an application layer, which is, again, just a suite of applications that depends on a fairly small number of transport protocols. And again, a single network layer protocol. And then a combined data link physical protocol, which just says, well, however you can best get the data from point to point, that's what you use. Okay.
No.
It's still a layered architecture. Again, you still go up and down through the layers as you go from node to node, and certainly as you go from source to destination. Okay, and so, and it uses the same principles of layering and encapsulation that were present before. So we start with, you know, a message or, you know, a data segment, and each layer then will add their own information to it without worrying about what's the actual meaning of the data before. Oh, gracious. Okay. So, again, it's good to be aware of, at least have some feel for what protocols are like at each of the different layers. Again, I think in one, when I posted the syllabus on the web, I indicated that we would be analyzing the MAC layer protocols, for instance. Well, the MAC layer protocols, well, that's just a sub-portion of the data link protocols. And again, we'll be looking at a somewhat abstract view of it. But if you look at all of the protocols, what you'll realize is that there's only a few very basic approaches that are taken. It's not like just anything goes. They may vary in small details, but just in the basic methodology, there's only a few ways things are done. And this is true at pretty much all of the layers. They're really, it's not that it varies completely and wildly depending. Okay. So if you're not really up on this, again, just take out some basic networks book and have a skim. Kuros is a good one. Tannenbaum is another good one. But again, both of those would be very, Stalling is another very readable author, and they're all going to say pretty much the same thing, and so just have a little skim and see what they're saying. Okay, so I'd forgotten I had to do that section, so now we'll have a very quick discussion of network performance, and we'll be returning to this, obviously, again and again throughout the module, because this is all about analyzing the performance of networks. Okay, so what I'd like you to take away from today is that there are two ways of looking at performance. There's the performance as seen by the network, and there's the performance as seen by an application running across the network. Okay. So if you're a network, what do you care about? Well, you probably care about getting as much data transported through as intact as possible. Okay. So throughput is the rate at which data is transmitted. Efficiency, it's related to throughput. It's How are the resources in the network utilized? How well are they utilized relative to how much data you're sending through? And loss, of course, is how much of the data did you actually get through in one piece? Okay. And this is great, but just because the network is performing wonderfully, it has a great throughput, very efficient, low loss rate, doesn't mean that any specific application has an acceptable quality of service. Okay. So we also have to look at individual applications and what their requirements are. And in actuality, the networks don't do a whole pile to cater to individual applications. So frequently, if you're analyzing this, what you do is you take some basic, you know, parameters for network performance, and you just then you add your application in and you try and see what happens. But there's very little effort to actually guarantee service for specific applications. Now you'll see in other modules that, you know, there are ways of trying to go about this, and we're not going to concern ourselves with those. Again, right now I just want to make the point that there are two different issues. There's what happens in the network and what happens to an individual application. Okay. And again, what the application cares about depends on what its end purpose is. So a voice transmission has much different requirements from a streaming video, has different requirements from a file transfer, etc. The ITUT recommendation G1010 gives a very nice summary of this. I'm not going to test you on it or anything, but again, it's surprisingly readable for something a standards body came up with. So it's worth having a look at if you're curious. Okay. Now, from the network point of view, performance depends on whether you're circuit switched or packet switched as well, which again shouldn't come as a surprise. Again, when we said with circuit switching, we were reserving resources. So you shouldn't have any issue about delay if you've got a circuit switch. If you've got a packet switch, you have to take congestion of networks into account. So what does matter within circuit switching? Well, the rate at which you can transmit your data, so the bit rate, or which can be translated into packet rates if you're trying to transmit packet data. The error rate makes a difference, and there's an end-to-end delay, obviously. Even if you have a circuit, well, just think, even if you stretch the big wire between Dublin and Beijing, the communication will not be instantaneous because it takes the signal a while to physically move through space or through a distance. Okay. And, as we mentioned before, there's also a delay in connection setups. So I'll skip any detailed discussion of bit error rates. Again, we can translate a bit error rate into essentially a packet error rate. So if you chunk up your data into blocks, what's the likelihood of a block getting there correctly? Okay, and so there's some issues around this sort of, if you do want to chunk up, one way of dealing with errors is to chunk up your data, and if there's an error in the block, resend that block, for instance, and this can be done even in a circuit switched situation. And so the question is, what sort of block size do you want? Well, the shorter your block, you know, the less probability any bit is wrong, therefore the less probability, or well, actually the same probability that the bit is wrong, but you've got less bits, so the overall probability of error is lower. But, again, there's more overhead, so if you have to process a block at a time, then the more blocks you have, the more overhead you have. Okay. And so assuming you've set up this connection, then, again, it's not instantaneous that you send a bit or a packet and it arrives at the other end. There's a number of factors that go into the time. So you have the time to form the bits, any processing, so any the sort of packaging of the bits. The propagation delay refers to the time it physically takes to move through a distance, And again, the connection setup. Okay. But still, socket switched networks are quite well behaved compared to packet switched networks. The main issue you hear talked about with circuit switch networks is blocking. So it's not an issue of once you have your circuit, then everything's fine, you're happy. But it's a matter of can you get that circuit and what's the probability that you can get a circuit. And my example is if you're driving down the Stillorgan Road on a Friday night trying to order a pizza, what's the probability that you'll actually be able to make that connection? And it's high, but it's not 100%. Okay. Now, packet switch networks have a whole different set of problems. And the usual assumption is that, well, most of the packets are going to get through eventually, but there's a real issue with for how long they take to get through. And again, this can be examined from a network perspective. What the network cares about is sort of overall statistics. In general, how fast am I getting packets through? In general, how many packets am I getting through? In general, how many are getting there all right? And then there's the view of individual packets. How long is it taking your specific packet that you've been waiting for, how long is it taking it to get through the network, and is that an acceptable amount of time? Okay. And the use of statistical multiplexing leads to delay, which is significantly unpredictable within the networks. So if you have a node and a whole bunch of packets descend on that node at once, then you're going to get a delay. The delay is a function of exactly how many packets are at that node at a given time. Okay. So, again, what can you do? You choose your packet size to balance between error rates and overhead as before. Packet size also has to suit various protocols. And sort of interestingly, various layers make different decisions as to the optimal size of a packet. So frequently what you'll have is between different layers, between the transport layer, the network layer, and the data link layer, they want to see different size of data, so the data is either aggregated or split up into more or less packets to suit protocols. And this is something, again, that in terms of performance gets lost because often we're examining a single protocol when it comes to performance. So frequently, at some point, you have to step back and say, well, actually, performance is an aggregate of all of the what happens at all of the different layers, not just a single one. Okay, so we have some probability that packets are either an error or lost, and that happens on a link-by-link basis, and it also happens end-to-end. So it could be that a packet essentially just can't find its way through the network. It's not lost in the sense it exists, but it can't find its way through. Again, IP, for instance, would have a way of eventually killing off those packets. So if they really got in massively lost, and it's likely that by the time they arrive, they're useless anyway, then it'll eventually kill them off. Okay. And then we have the delay in the transmission of packets. Okay, and so we have all the same delays that we had for circuit switching, and then a few new ones. So we've got the transmission time, we've got all the processing times. Now we have a store and forward delay. So we said that if you create a circuit, you can just essentially keep things pushing through that circuit with at most a bit time delay. With packets, again, they're being processed at each node, so they need to arrive at the node completely before they can be forwarded on. So there's an issue that they're retransmitted at each node. So if you have a circuit switch, they're transmitted once and essentially carries forward. If you have packet switching, there's a transmission delay at each node. Okay. And then again, when you get to the node, you might have to get in line. So there's a delay if the node has a lot of work to do. Okay. And what's very frustrating for applications is that this delay can vary a lot. It might, you know, like if you thought, even if you're sending all your packets through exactly the same set of nodes, exactly along the same path, the other packets coming in can vary tremendously. And so at one point, you might those packets might be waiting, and at another point, they might just sail through. Okay, so again, because of the statistical multiplexing, you end up having multiple contributors to a node, and the node has some way of allocating its resources up and amongst the multiple contributors, but you don't know what that is necessarily, and if there's too much going on, then you start, you know, the packets start stacking up, they're stored, and you have to wait. Also, if too many packets stack up, the response of the node is going to be to start dropping those packets. So not only do you have delay, but potentially you also have loss. Okay. Now, so again, just to sum up, that leads to four sources of delay. The processing time, okay, the queuing delay, the transmission delay, and the propagation delay. So the time it takes to examine a packet, decide what to do with it, the time it takes waiting to actually get our resources, the time it takes to form up a packet, and then finally the time it takes to physically get that packet moving along some sort of wire. Okay. So, in this example, again, the cars represent packets. And if we the propagation is, again, how fast the car can go. So it's driving along a road at 100 kilometers per hour. So if the length of the road is 100 kilometers, it'll take an hour for it to get there. Okay. It takes, each car takes a bit of time to clear a toll booth, in this case 12 seconds. And so you can ask about, so that's the time it takes. So you can ask something, if you have a number of packets in train, how long will they take to sort of clear either one or a series of toll booths? Okay. So the question we asked here was, how long does it take for this last car, the 10th car, to come to the second toll booth? Okay. And so what you can see is that this 10th car is going to experience queuing delays. We've got 9 cars to process before it. So at the first toll booth, you're going to have a total of 120 seconds for this last car to clear the toll booth. Okay. So that's the queuing delay. And then once you've cleared the toll booth, well, you still have the propagation. You still have to physically move from one to the next. And again, it takes 60 minutes or 1 hour for the car to move from one toll booth to the next. Okay. So we've changed this a little just to show that this isn't necessarily very realistic in terms of a network. We now have a supercar that travels at 1,000 kilometers per hour. And so how long does it take? And it now takes 1 minute to clear the toll booth. So one car is going to get, the first car gets to the toll booth in 7 minutes. And in 7 minutes, the toll booth has been able to process 7 of these 10 cars. Okay. So if you change the sort of ratio between the propagation time and the transmission time, then you see that you get a different picture where not everything has cleared your first node before it arrives at the second node. So again, you get this pipelining going on if you have a situation like that. Okay. So again, there's these 4 components per delay. And I'm picking up the pace a little bit here for those of you who are just looking at the Camtasia because we're running out of time in the lecture. So what impacts on queuing delay? Well, what impacts on queuing delay is pretty much just what is arriving at the node relative to how fast you can process what's arriving in any individual packet. Okay. So, at the very least, you need to be able to process, or on average, process a packet faster than they're arriving. So, and the closer you get to the arrival times being equal to the processing times, the bigger your queuing delays are likely to become. And so, again, that will be revisited in gory detail when you get to queues. Okay. And again, the other problem with queues is, well, you have this delay, which is unpredictable and possibly large. And if your there's too much strain put on your node, then if the queue becomes too big, then typically the node will just start dropping packets and you have loss as well. Okay. Now, another measure of a network is throughput. And the throughput in the network is going to be a function of the throughput on various links. And so what throughput means is, again, it's the rate at which packets pass any given link. And so if you've got 2 different links with 2 different rates, then the combination is going to be essentially the slower of them. Okay. So if you have one link with a higher throughput and one link with a lower throughput, then the end-to-end throughput is going to be the lower of the two. Okay. So this is the idea of a bottleneck. Okay. So at some point in your network, if you've got a single resource that's problematic, then it can have a huge impact sort of on the whole network. Okay. And again, this is just an example. The idea is that it's the smallest throughput that constrains your output. Okay, and as I mentioned earlier, frequently if we think of this core versus access, the throughput in the car is quite good, and that's not where the problem is. The problem is the links at the access, and that can be at sort of either end, and but it doesn't matter exactly where it is. Again, it doesn't matter that our, from an application standpoint, it doesn't matter that most of the network is performing very well if there are, again, single points of problems, and you just happen to get unlucky and you have to go through one of those points. Okay, so this is the last slide, I promise. I think. Actually, there's a wrap-up slide after it. Just returning to this example, since it's the only thing where we tossed any numbers around at all. What we've seen so far is that we have a number of contributors to delay, and these have to do with the traffic itself. So the question is, right here we said we had 10 cars, we said that each one of them had spent so much time on a toll booth. How do we know that? In general, what we have is we have a very random number of cars. Okay. The number of cars is based on what users are doing what at any given time. And so we have to model the input to our problem is not just, you know, again, these single numbers, but it's a random distribution. So you might say we have one between 1 and 10 cars with equal probability. That would, again, be not terribly realistic, but it would be more likely than having exactly 10 cars. Okay. At the toll booth, there's also probably a bit of randomness in how long each car is going to spend at the toll booth. So we've said every car spends a minute or 50 seconds or whatever, but in reality, each car probably spends a slightly different amount of time. Okay. So again, what we're going to need to do is model some sort of random distribution for the toll booth. Okay. So we have a random number of cars, a random amount of time each car takes to get through the toll booth, and now we want to ask these questions about performance. How long, when are all 10 cars going to get here? Well, the answer is you can't give a single number to that. You can't give a single number because it all depends on when the 10 cars got here and how long they took. But you should be able to perhaps give a distribution. So you should be able to in some way characterize how the 10 cars are arriving here. And then maybe answer questions like, on average, how many cars are here at this point? Or on average, how long does it take? Or what's the variability in the time? And so that's what's going to follow in the rest of this module, is taking these basic parameters, acknowledging that they're actually the basic things are okay, but there's uncertainty. We don't know. We can't give a specific number to any of these parameters. And in the absence of being able to give a specific number, are we able to still say something meaningful? And the answer is yes. Again, queuing allows you to come up with sort of quite elegant results, which are going to be more realistic than this, certainly, but perhaps not quite realistic enough for sort of certainty. And in the case where queuing doesn't give us enough realism, we can turn to simulation. And again, we can model anything, you know, we can make our model, a simulation model, as complex as we want and as sort of something so strange as we want. And then the question becomes, if we have this weird and wonderful simulation model, how do we interpret the output of that simulation model? Okay, so my apologies for running late. And so next lecture will be taken by Connor McArdle, and again we'll be starting with just a basic, from the basics of probability, moving on to building up the theory behind cues. Okay.